Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas. Loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm JB Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And, you know, we had to actually verify our identities before walking into the podcast, which is just standard operating procedure here at How Stuff Works.
Oh, right. It's a blood sample, retina scan, and fingerprint before we're allowed to enter any doors.
Yeah, it's really awkward. That's why most of us no longer wait till the last minute to have to run to the bathroom because disaster can strike. But it does mean that we thought, hey, we should talk about biometrics. And then we started looking into it and getting really excited. And then we realized, hey, there's a lot to talk about.
Right. You know, biometrics, of course, being the measurable biological or behavioral characteristics used for any given individual.
Yes. This is what how the FBI says this is what the biometrics are. So, you know, it's one of those things where we knew it was a huge topic and we decided to narrow it down. So today we're specifically focusing on your fingerprints.
Well, not your fingerprints. Well, no. I mean everyone's fingerprints.
You know, no, see the person sitting next to you? No, not that one, the other one. That person's fingerprints. That's the one we're concentrating on. So yeah.
Well, because everyone has different fingerprints. I mean, like everyone.
Right. And this is something that has been known for a while, but then forgotten and then rediscovered. So we're going to talk about that because it's kind of funny. So these days we think of biometrics as sort of those automated ways to verify your identity based on some sort of biological characteristic, like, you know, the eye scan or the fingerprint scan or whatever, vocal scans as well, you know, like the voice imprint, lots of different Hollywood versions of this. But, you know, again, going into that fingerprint approach, we thought that, you know, we'd look at not just how we've defined it and how stuff works, but look at a whole history of fingerprinting. We're not the first podcast to do this, by the way.
Certainly not. Josh and Chuck of Stuff You Should Know did an episode on April 3rd, 2013 called How Fingerprinting Works, and they go pretty deeply into the history and say many pithy things. So if you would like to check that episode out, you can go to stuffyoushouldknow.com.
Right. And just stick around because we're going to say some pithy things, too. We are going to cover some of the history, kind of a quick overview. But first, I thought I would read a couple of little excerpts from our article on how fingerprint scanners work, because there are a couple that I thought were really interesting.
From HowStuffWorks.com.
Yes.
Neither of us actually wrote this.
Nope. I didn't write this one. This one says, people have tiny ridges of skin on their fingers because this particular adaptation was extremely advantageous to the ancestors of the human species. The pattern of ridges and valleys on fingers make it easier for the hands to grip things in the same way a rubber tread pattern helps a tire grip the road. The other function of fingerprints is a total coincidence. Like everything in the human body, these ridges form through a combination of genetic and environmental factors. The genetic code in DNA gives general orders on the way skin should form in the developing fetus, but the specific way it forms is a result of random events. The exact position of the fetus in the womb at a particular moment and the exact composition and density of surrounding amniotic fluid decides how every individual ridge will form.
This, by the way, is how identical twins can have different fingerprints.
Pretty cool. Because, you know, genetically, they're identical, but their fingerprints
are different.
Still different.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So looking at this history, you might think, okay, I've heard about fingerprinting, particularly when it applies to law enforcement. That's probably where a lot of people are familiar with it besides the verification angle.
Sure. And a couple popular media pieces have talked recently about, you get things like Ripper Street or Sleepy Hollow having characters going like this new fingerprinting thing in the amazing age of Victoria.
Yeah. Not so much actually. So fingerprints, people have been aware of them for ages because we're curious folks. You know, human beings, we're very curious and narcissistic. We like to learn stuff and we like to look at ourselves. And how do I know that this dates back ages and ages and ages ago? Because we have prehistoric depictions found in Nova Scotia. And it depicted a hand with ridge patterns on the skin. Now, that does not mean that the ancient Nova Scotians were familiar with the fact that all the fingerprints were unique and therefore no two individuals had the same ones. But it at least showed that, you know, yeah, they noticed them.
But the ancient Babylonians may have actually used fingerprints to differentiate people. We've found fingerprints in clay to sign business transactions. And the ancient Chinese use inked fingerprints for both business purposes and child identification.
And in the 1300s in Persia, official government documents often included fingerprints, probably to indicate they were authorized and official. Now, according to the U.S. Marshal's Office, which has an entire webpage devoted to fingerprinting and the history of it,
mm-hmm.
One government official in Persia at that time made the observation that no two fingerprints were alike, which obviously would be very important if you're making a document official or authorized.
Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until the 1880s, that amazing age of Victoria previously mentioned, that we got some kind of official classification system.
Right. It wasn't until the modern era that we started seeing it in, it wasn't even in wide use at the beginning. It was just kind of exploratory. Dr. Henry Faulds back in 1880 proposed using fingerprints for identification as well as a means of classifying them. So he forwarded these ideas to a certain Charles Darwin,
mm-hmm.
a very important historical figure in his own right. But Darwin at the time was toward the end of his life and felt that he did not have the necessary time and energy to devote to this. Thought it was really interesting, however, so he forwarded the information along to a cousin of his named Francis Galton. So Faulds would write a scientific paper about his methods and actually identified a fingerprint. You know, ascertain the identity of the person who left that fingerprint on a bottle of alcohol. Shouldn't come as any surprise, I guess.
Booze brings us all together.
It does.
Then in 1883, Mark Twain would use this new startling scientific information in a story.
Yeah, it was in Life on the Mississippi. And in that, one of the elements of that story is a murderer is identified through the use of fingerprints. And he would revisit the idea in a book called Pudd'nhead Wilson.
Pudd'nhead Wilson.
Yeah. So it's interesting. Now, this was before anyone was actually using fingerprints in any kind of criminal investigations on an official basis. It had not been established.
It was science fiction, really, at the time.
It kind of was.
So that was exciting. But soon, in 1888, Sir Francis Galton, remember the cousin to Charles Darwin, mm-hmm. who had received information about this about 10 years previous, began his own study of fingerprints.
Yep. He wrote a book in 1892 and put forth a formal classification system and identify the tiny characteristics used to differentiate fingerprints, which now we call Galton's details. He also observed that fingerprints don't change over the lifetime of a person. So the ones you have when you're a kid are the same ones you have when you're old. He originally wanted to kind of link fingerprints to certain types of traits like intelligence or heredity.
Which is so racist.
Yeah, kind of essentially... I think this was almost an attempt, and I don't know enough about Galton to say this for sure, but it seems like an attempt to justify certain society's beliefs in certain people, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it wasn't necessarily so racist, but
at any rate,
it kind of runs in that direction.
Yeah, because I mean, the idea that you could identify a person's intelligence based on their fingerprints already seems a little sketchy, and in fact, he did. Determined that there was no connection. There were no identifier marks in a person's fingerprints that would give you any clue as to that person's intelligence or genetic background. However, he did figure out that there were a lot of differences and that people weren't likely to have the same fingerprints.
Yeah, unlikely in the order of 1 in 64 billion.
That's pretty unlikely. So in 1891, we get the first use of fingerprints in a criminal investigation on an official level. Juan Vucetic, and I'm sure I butchered his last name, who was a police officer in Argentina, used them in a murder investigation. It was actually a really tragic case, but the discovery meant that he was able to solve this mystery and prove that the person that was believed to have been the murderer was in fact not the killer. So, not only was it the first use, but it was a pretty dramatic example of it. Now, we're going to skip to 1918, but between the late 19th century and the early 20th century, you started to see fingerprints get adopted into various legal, organizations all around the world. The United Kingdom and the United States were leading the way, but it was all over the place. So by 1918, you have Edmond Lacard, who says that you only need 12 points of similarity between an individual's fingerprint and a target fingerprint to serve as a positive identification. Now, you may have heard about those 12 points of singularity, that this is somehow like a legal thing, that if you were able to meet those 12 points of singularity, you have the legal basis to say this person did this thing.
Did that thing, right.
Not necessarily a legal definition at all. In fact, countries have very, very different ways of saying whether or not a fingerprint is a valid match for another one. And some, like the United States, do not have a minimum number of resemblances that need to be there in order for you to call it a match. Now, usually law enforcement agencies rely on experts who give their expert opinion and therefore are putting their own reputation on the line as to whether or not something matches. And of course, now, these days, we rely very heavily on digital information, which
with very, very complex and intelligent algorithms that will do some really interesting legwork.
Yeah. And so with that, you know, the level of confidence grows quite a bit. So just so you know, that 12 points of similarity, not necessarily a legal
standard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 1924, that's when Congress had an act that established the new division for the Federal Bureau of Investigation, also known as the FBI. And this division was called the Identification Division. I bet you can guess what it did. So it became kind of a centralized fingerprint file for the entire country. So it wasn't necessarily a standard procedure for every law enforcement agency out there to send a copy to the FBI. But that's kind of what started to happen so that there could be this sort of cooperation between different departments, which often wouldn't have any communication with each other.
Sure. By 1946, the FBI would have processed more than 100 million fingerprint cards.
Yeah. Not just processed, but they did that by hand.
Right. And it would be 200 million by 1971.
So 200 million physical cards with fingerprints on them. I mean, just imagine how many, like how much storage you need just for, I mean, it's 200. I can't even imagine it. But by 1999, the FBI introduced the Integrated Automated Fingerprint Identification System, or IFIS. So it's the largest fingerprint database in the world, and it's computer automated. It takes about 27 minutes for the system to comb through every single file in its database to find out if there is a potential match during a criminal investigation. It's different if it's a civil case. It's actually like more than an hour. But for criminal investigation, for all the criminal files that are stored in this database, 27 minutes from the time you actually input the suspect's fingerprint.
I imagine that's a lot faster than whatever intern they sent down to the basement.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because, I mean, you would have to narrow down the person quite a bit before you could ever start comparing
use
against
that
those
kind
cards.
Of information, sure.
Right. Like, this is a man, so cut out all the women and then go. Like, there are 70 million of them down there. Yeah, that would be a daunting task. So in the digital age, we can actually analyze this stuff way better than we ever could. Like, you don't have to use the naked eye anymore and try and find those little ridges and stuff. You can actually rely very heavily upon computer systems.
Mm-hmm. And once we started getting those computer systems, in place, they pretty soon thereafter became, commercially available.
Yeah. We had some fingerprint verification systems that have been around for a few decades. Now, on the consumer level, they've only been available fairly recently. And you might be thinking, oh, yeah, the iPhone 5S, because it has that fingerprint scanner where you can use that to log into your phone. That's the first smartphone to ever use that, right?
Nope.
No. There's actually a mobile device. The first mobile device that I found was one that dated from 2003. The name of this is phenomenal. HP names their products in such catchy ways. It's the HP IPAC, IPAQ, PPC 5500 Pocket PC.
Oh, yeah.
It just rolls off the tongue.
So sexy.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, with a name like that, how could you resist? iPhone, schmiphone. So at any rate, this was the first mobile device to incorporate finger scanning technology.
But it was also sort of the edge of a boom for the technology. It was being extended for wide consumer use at the time. I mean, you know, keyboards and mice had them, laptops had them. You could buy a USB scanner for multi-purpose use and encrypt everything with your fingerprint.
Right. You could end up creating, for example, with a copier, you could end up telling people, all right, this group of folks are authorized to make copies. Anyone who's not on this list cannot make copies. And you would walk up to make copies, and if you weren't on that list, then I guess no fun Christmas party shenanigans for you.
But also opening this up to the consumer market meant that a lot of people started finding the flaws in the technology.
Oh, yes. In December 15th, 2005, Clarkson University researchers announced that they could fool 90% of the world's fingerprint scanners using an incredibly sophisticated, expensive substance.
Play-Doh.
Yeah, they could just go out to Toy Store and buy some Play-Doh and essentially make a copy of a fingerprint and put it on any optical scanner. And we'll talk about the optical scanners in a little bit. And it worked really well. So that gave people some pause and thought maybe we should come up with something besides optical scanners to, because fingerprint identification is a great idea, but if it's that easy to fool, we have to find a different way of measuring it.
Mm-hmm.
So then there was a totally different expose on September 21st, 2006, when our beloved Mythbusters decided to do a fingerprint scanner scam of their own. They decided to see if they could fool one, and this one was a little different. It wasn't just an optical scanner. It was supposed to also detect sweat from pores in the fingertips.
Okay, so you can't just use a lump of Play-Doh or a really
picture.
Good photograph.
Yeah, uh-huh. You'd have to have something that sweats. Has to. Otherwise, it's never going to work. So what did they do? They made a latex copy of a fingerprint, and then they did a very sophisticated thing in order to simulate sweat.
They licked it.
Yeah, and it worked. So if you can't Play-Doh it, lick it, I guess, is the moral of that story.
I think that that's really what we all should learn from this today.
Probably. So anyway, they're still seeing this kind of technology being rolled out, but it's not just in optical scanners. And even optical scanners have gotten a lot better than they were back in 2005. So we're going to cover exactly how they work. But before we do that, let's take a quick break to thank our sponsor.
Working remotely? Where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
All right, I had just talked about optical scanners, and those are one of the ones that are the easiest to explain and fairly common even today. In fact, not my work computer, but my home computer has, my home laptop has a little optical scanner. So if I want to log in, I can just swipe my finger across it. So optical scanners use something that is found in digital cameras and camcorders called a charge coupled device, or CCD. Now, essentially, that's a light sensor. It's got an array of things called photosites. Now, that's light sensitive diodes, and it's works pretty much the way you would imagine. So photons, those little particles of light, when they make a collision with these photosites, it generates a little electrical signal.
Mm-hmm. And those can then be compiled and converted into a digital image. Mm-hmm. It's essentially the same process that digital cameras use to take pictures.
Yep. And here's the thing, though. So if I put my finger on an optical scanner, I'm actually blocking light. And unless you happen to be E.T., the extraterrestrial, your finger probably isn't emitting light. So how the heck is it getting this picture? Well, it uses a flash.
Yeah.
Except in this case, a flash is probably like a single LED, or for some scanners, maybe an array of LEDs, light emitting diodes, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
And so that provides the light that is necessary to take this image. And then the CCD creates an image of your fingertip. However, it's a little funky.
It's inverted, right? The dark areas are going to represent the ridges, the raised portions of your fingertip, and the light areas are going to represent the valleys.
Yeah, so it's kind of like looking at a negative, a photo negative. And it makes sense because stuff that's reflecting more light is going to create a bigger electrical signal, thus creating that, mm-hmm. you know, the charge couple device is going to make that into a darker portion. The valleys, the light is not as much of it's going to reflect back. So you get a weaker electrical signal. That's why it gets lighter. So if you were to scan your finger and it tells you that it's a good scan because most of these devices also have some sort of fail-safe in them that will alert you if there wasn't enough differentiation between the dark and light parts.
Right. The same way that your camera sometimes will take a picture that's overdeveloped or underdeveloped. The same thing can happen here.
Yeah. So if you wanted to, most of the software has that error function mm-hmm. built into it, so it can tell.
And it will ask you to scan again.
Right. So then you would scan again. So if it's the first time you're using it, then you would also end up creating a profile in some way. It might not be you. It might be an administrator, but something that links the fingerprint to who you are and what access you are supposed to have will happen. Then on subsequent uses, what will happen is that when you scan your finger, it'll go through its database of identities that have fingerprints attached to them. Look for you. If you're there, then it will authorize you for whatever use you're allowed. So, for instance, on my home computer, I've given myself very strict restrictions because I am not to be trusted. And so all I'm able to do is play a pirated copy of Flappy Bird. That's not true. I don't have Flappy Bird. But at any rate, you know, that's the basic procedure, right? And so if your fingerprint is not found in that database, you get an error. So either you have to swipe it again or scan it again if it's not a swipe. You know, it all depends on what kind of scanner you're at. Or you end up saying, the jig is up. You got me. I don't really belong here. And then you run away. So that's the basic thing. And what they're looking for is not the entire pattern of your fingertip.
It's looking for specific minutia about it, certain types of patterns, and it depends on the software that the scanner is using. It might be the places where the ridges converge or split apart at the end, or any other kind of detail that's going to be unique to you.
Right. So in other words, all it has to do is say, hey, there are these three points on this fingertip that are unique. That's all I'm concerned about. And if the fingerprint that's scanned has those three points, I know it's this person and they can be let through. By concentrating on the minutia, then you really cut down on all the rest of the data that's necessary to have a verification.
Right. You can kind of throw everything else out and concentrate on that. And right. And they're pretty good. Like we said, though, they can sometimes be fooled by a really high quality picture of a fingerprint.
Right. So what if you, instead of looking at a picture, you were to measure the fingerprint in some other way? Such as capacitance.
Right, because capacitance touch screens are totally a thing.
Yeah, so it's very similar to what a regular capacitance touch screen is. So, you know, there are different ways of doing touch screens as well. There's some where you have to use pressure.
Mm-hmm.
The benefit of that is you could be wearing gloves and still work a pressure version.
The downside is that when people are expected to apply pressure to delicate material, they sometimes destroy it completely.
Right, or it'll at least decrease the lifespan of that object by quite a bit. Capacitance, however, uses weak electric fields. So when you make contact with a screen, a touch screen that's using capacitance, so you're a conductor. I don't mean that you conduct trains, nor do I mean that you...
Maybe you do.
Maybe you do. Maybe you do. Maybe you conduct orchestras. Maybe you conduct orchestras on a train. I don't know, but that's not what I'm talking about.
If you do, call us, because that sounds fascinating.
That would be kind of cool, actually. But no, I'm talking about electrical conductivity.
Mm-hmm.
So we can conduct electricity. It's not great for us to have a lot of it, but tiny amounts don't hurt us.
Sure. And as it turns out, the ridges and valleys on your fingers conduct slightly different amounts of electricity.
This blows my mind. I mean, to think that the raised parts of your fingerprint and the valleys of your fingerprint are distinct enough to create a measurable difference in capacitance, it's something I never would have imagined.
And it's really a sensor issue here. I mean, the fact that we can create these cells, these capacitor plate cells that are sensitive enough to tell that.
Yeah.
Technology.
So what's happening is when you put your finger down on one of these capacitance scanners, you are actually, you're acting as a capacitance plate, right? Your fingertip is acting as one, and you already have other ones inside the scanner itself. And it'll end up creating voltages. And there will be differences in those voltages, the differences between the ridges and the valleys.
Based on how far away they are from the cells.
Yeah. So if it's a valley, it's going to be lower capacitance because the distance is greater. Capacitance mm-hmm. is very dependent upon distance.
Mm-hmm.
So if you move two capacitance plates far enough apart, they will not work together.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
So it's amazing that the valleys, just by being that much further away, will create a different voltage than the ridges.
And then having a whole set of these cells set up next to one another, it allows the scanner to sort of make a digital picture of your fingerprint, but just using electricity rather than light. The data from each one is, again, compiled and then converted into an image of sorts.
Yeah, yeah. You can think of it as like an image made with electricity. And this is the sort of scanner that the iPhone 5S uses. So it's not an optical scanner. One of the big benefits of this technology is that it's easier to make it really compact and miniaturized, which is why you could find it in things like handheld electronics.
Right, sure. However, this technology can also be fooled sometimes by mold of a finger. Or if someone has gone and calibrated the scanner to look for things like heat or a pulse, you can use one of those movie tricks, like a gelatin or silicone mold of a finger, pasted onto
a different finger. Yeah. My favorite version of getting past a capacitance or an optical scanner is to use the finger that's been removed from the person who had the authorization.
Yeah.
Yeah. Snipping the finger off.
That's your favorite?
That's my favorite.
Out in the field? That's what you like
you
doing?
You know, we had this discussion about the Bourne identity before we came into the podcast. This is totally true. I don't like to discuss my actual field operative kind of mentality and strategies, but yes, I do love doing that. So thermal scanners. Well, this one's a little different because it's a heat scanner. And again, it's one of those ideas where it measures the differences in heat between ridges and valleys.
Sure.
Once again, you're going to get a slightly higher temperature from the ridges than you do with the valleys. The valleys are essentially pockets of air. There's some downsides with this one. One of the problems with thermal scanners is that if it takes too long to do the scan, the temperature differences are going to equalize across
the plate
ridges.
And wind up you get like erasing it as it's
just
going.
You just get a blank fingerprint, like a big blank fingerprint, not useful. This next one is super cool. It's ultrasonic sensors. So
We did a whole episode about ultrasound called How Ultrasound Works, crazily enough, that published on January 13th, 2014, if you would like to hear all about how this technology works. But it's essentially echolocation.
Yeah, you're sending out sound signals and then you're waiting for them to bounce back. And by measuring the amount of time it took to go out and come back, you get an idea of how far away something is. Well, that works, you know, in lots of different ways, including being able to tell a fingerprint, being able to read a fingerprint.
Mm-hmm. It can go even deeper than that.
Exactly. Right? It can go into tissue. So if you wanted, you could create an ultrasonic fingerprint scanner that scanned not just the fingerprint itself, but the underlying veins that are in your finger, which also are going to be unique to you. So that's a lot harder to fake than a fingerprint. Like, you're not going to get a really high resolution image of veins and then create a fake finger easily.
It would be really difficult. I mean, but you could use your favorite application, which is removing someone's finger and using that, right?
Unless you had also built into the software to detect living tissue. Because
to see if blood is moving through the veins or the vessels.
If it's not detecting blood, it's going to say, y'all, this is messed up. You need to send someone down right now to the fingerprint scanner. Things that are bad are happening. That's exactly the voice it uses, too.
I assumed.
I run into it in the field all the time. So, yeah, I mean, this is, we're making light of it because to be serious about it is so squicky.
And terrifying.
But at any rate, it does mean that you can build those sort of parameters in. So it's not just looking at the fingerprint and the veins underneath, but also to make sure it is truly a valid entry so that they don't, you don't end up compromising security. And there's also, I wanted to mention very briefly, the difference between those static fingerprint scanners, especially the optical ones where you just hold your finger down and you wait for it. It's kind of like a copier.
Right. And the swipe style that you were talking about having on your home laptop.
Exactly. So if you've ever had a laptop or any other device that has like a narrow window and you're supposed to swipe your finger across that window, the reason for that is that it's actually taking a series of quote unquote images of your finger. However, the implementation is actually being used. It's doing that in a quick series. Machines are really fast, so they can do this without any real problem.
Uh-huh.
They're looking for those minutiae that we talked about before.
And they're able to use software to compile them. But, you know, it's nifty having the smaller form factor because, like we said, then you can miniaturize, you can put them in something like a cell phone.
Right.
And also make them cheaper.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You've got this little window and your finger moves past the window instead of the window having to be big enough to
cover
fit
your whole
finger. Fingers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's really an interesting development and pretty cool. Also, we can mention that biometric systems, many of them, not necessarily all of them, but many of them end up translating your fingerprint into an algorithm does the translating that turns it into a bunch of ones and zeros.
Right. A digitization, sometimes called a hash. It's like a personal code, like a really long PIN.
Yeah. So in this case, what you would say is that it's not storing an image of your fingerprint. It's not like if you were to somehow hack into the computer, you would suddenly see on your screen, a representation of your fingerprint. It would just mean that it would take the pattern of ridges and valleys and all the minutiae, convert that into this hash, this long string of ones and zeros. And the next time you scan it, if a same hash comes up, then it is a match and it says, all right, identification has been verified,
mm-hmm.
but it's not actually like an actual real image of your fingerprint. And the reason why a lot of these companies try to talk about, this as a big selling point is that it doesn't allow you to recreate a person's fingerprint if you were to get hold of those hashes. So it's not like you would say, oh, if I just put this through an image program, I suddenly get a picture of that fingerprint. You would just get gibberish.
That's the way I think that the iPhone 5S and the Galaxy something.
The latest Samsung incorporates
it. And PayPal these days even has fingerprint signatures on their app. And any device that allows you to scan in your fingerprint will...
Let
you pay for stuff on PayPal with that signature.
I'm sure we're going to see a lot of that kind of stuff incorporated with things like the NFC technology or even the low energy Bluetooth implementations where your fingerprint, instead of having to put in a pin, you just swipe your finger.
I kind of hope that it's an additional safety feature, not a standalone safety feature, because, unlike a password or a pin, you can't just change your fingerprint if it gets stolen. And this hash issue adds security to the whole thing. It's harder to, but I'm sure that someone, if they really wanted to, could decode a hash and figure out what that scan looks like.
Yeah. Maybe. I mean, they would have to have a lot of information, but it is important to say that there is no security feature out there that's going to be 100% perfect.
Oh, of course.
Right. There's nothing out there. So having it as an additional tool, I agree, Lauren. That's the best way of looking at it. I think anytime we decide that we're going to rely on a specific implementation and that's it and we're done, we're good, then we're pretty much dooming ourselves to getting hacked in some way down the line, because people are smart and they figure out ways around rules.
They do, and I really don't want to have to change my fingerprints.
Not again. All right, so that wraps up this episode of Tech Stuff. Folks, if you have suggestions for future topics, you should let us know, because otherwise we're just going to keep doing what we're doing. Let us know by sending us an email. Our address is techstuff@discovery.com, or drop us a line on Facebook, Twitter, or Tumblr. Our handle is TechStuffHSW, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Vedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.